I want to welcome you to the Retro Rogues Live podcast. This is a segment from last week's live video show. The live show is available every Wednesday at 7 p.m. on Twitch, YouTube, and Twitter. Simply search for BassGod14, that's BASSGOD14, on either YouTube, Twitch, or Twitter. And now, on with the show. Talking about favorite comic books from yesteryear. This is a fun topic that I enjoy revisiting. I know from our listener survey that people are hoping to see some more fun comic book based content on the show. And this is obviously a direct response to that. Plus also, I enjoy talking about this kind of content anyway. I know Eric does as well. So this is kind of a fun thing. So I'm going to start off here with the, I'd call it the black sheep of these favorite comics from yesteryear, but it's actually a kangaroo, amazingly enough. So we're starting off, I'm going to be talking about Lee Marr's Preteen Dirty Jean Kung Fu Kangaroos, number one. This was published in August of 1986. This is from Blackthorn Publishing. Just a little bit of background here about Lee Marr's. She was born in September of 1945, is an American cartoonist and animator, and one of the first female underground comics creators. That's right. This was created by a female creator, and this is one of my favorite comics. She is best known for her comic book series, The Further Fattening Adventures of Pudge, Girl Blimp, which lasted from 1973 to 1977. And as I stated, she is an important figure in the underground comics movement. I have always loved this silly comic book. Obviously, it's a spoof. It's in response to Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. It very boldly states on the cover that in addition to the adventures of the Kung Fu Kangaroos, you're also going to get an extraordinarily short, the critical appearance of the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles by none other than one of their original creators, Peter Laird. If you want to know what that is, you're going to have to find a copy of this and read it. Because I don't want to spoil it. This is a very fun, expressive, obviously, comic strip cartoony kind of approach to the style. It's a lot of fun. You can see how it's kind of different because it says Kung Fu Kangaroos and they're using guns. It's really wild and outlandish, but it's a lot of fun. This is obviously a first issue, so you get the usual setup. You know, they get their powers or they get their skills and they go out and they have like a wild, rollicking adventure. I've always enjoyed this comic quite a bit. So tell me, Eric, have you ever heard of the Preteen Dirty Jean Kung Fu Kangaroos?
I can't say that I have. I have not heard of this book at all before.
This is one I often talk to when I'm talking to people because I'm a huge fan of independent comics. When I was in my very formative years when I was younger, the black and white explosion of the 80s was rampant. And we have so many things that came out of the black and white explosion. And by black and white, I'm talking about the interior pages of this are only printed in black and white. There's no color. It was a very affordable way to produce a comic in those days. Bushytail was my first creator, was actually my second creator on the series, was also done black and white. And I'm a huge fan of a lot of this material. During the black and white explosion of the 80s, you not only had things like the Kung Fu Kangaroos here, but a lot of really important properties emerged. Whether you're talking about Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, whether you're talking about Rocketeer, whether you're talking about Men in Black, there's a lot of important content. You know, The Crow, for example, by James LeBar. A lot of important titles emerged during this period. And I've always had a fondness for a lot of these books, things like this. I've mentioned before, things like Adventures, the Warriors series, a lot of fun comics from this time period. So if this interests you at all, if you like Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, if you'd like to read one of the interesting sort of sideline things that TMNT inspired, but caught on with a very small niche group, but probably didn't catch on enough to have its own animated series or toy line, I definitely recommend running down a copy of Preteen Dirty Jean Kung Fu Kangaroos. If you keep an eye out for it, this is probably something you might find in a 50-cent bin or a dollar box somewhere. But it's a fun read and an interesting artifact from the black and white explosion that happened in the comic industry in the 1980s.
Yeah, I have to say, you know, it was an interesting time you know, this is all obviously in the wake of Teenage Mutant Turtles. And I mean, there was just a huge glut of independent books. And I think it was probably a very interesting time to be an independent creator back then, because there were some other interesting hits and things like that, that even still endure, you know, in one form or another to this day. But there was yeah. also a lot of stuff that's completely forgotten, and it did basically cause a crash for the comic book industry,
right?
Because a lot of stores ended up with a huge number of books they couldn't sell. So it's an interesting time. It's an interesting time period just in comic book history, when you had all these black and white comics coming out. I actually have a pretty substantial collection of independent comics, especially since for the days that I used to go to San Diego Comic-Con. So I have some very obscure titles that probably had a very, very limited circulation and things like that, because that was one of the few places where you could find a lot of this content after the crash, you know?
Right, right.
So it's an interesting time period. It seems to me like this is almost like a time capsule in a lot of ways, because I don't know how a book like this would be received today in the industry, you know?
Yeah, I don't either. And there's weird too, because there's a lot of titles that people don't really associate or think of, or sometimes even remember, like you were mentioning, like Fish Police at one time. Steve Mancuso's Fish Police was so popular at one time that they actually produced an animated series that had John Ritter actually provide one of the voices. I never hear anyone talking about Fish Police anymore. And a lot of people were betting that Fish Police could actually break big. And then you have a lot of weird oddball titles, you know, like, for example, you know, something like Men in Black. You know, the rights for it were snatched up right away, but no one really thought that Men in Black was going to become much of anything. And then it spawned, you know, like a film franchise of four films. And at one point was very popular. It had a long running animated series as well. And it has a lot of diehard fans that still quite love that particular franchise. So it's interesting, the things that click with people, the things that don't. But the 80s was definitely a very, very interesting time. This will not be the first time as we continue to move forward doing the show and hopefully revisit favorite comics from yesteryears. I'm going to be bringing more of these kind of interesting titles to light and talking about these fun, interesting diversions.
So, uh-huh.
Cool. All right. So if you want, we'll move on to your pick, if that'll work.
So for a little bit of background, back with the days of the audio show, we were going to do a spinner rack special where we were going to talk about books that we got off of the rack, not at a comic book store necessarily, that we came across in our childhood. And unfortunately, when we did that episode, I didn't have access to my childhood comic books. I didn't know where they were. And I realized later that they were at my parents' house. The books that I have here, you know, where I live, they're more modern books. They're not the stuff from the 80s and things like that when I was a kid. So kind of to make up for that, that's why I came up with this. This is probably the only issue of Thor that I actually physically own. I don't know if I have any other issues of Thor. And as I like to always say, the funny thing about me with comics is that, you know, I didn't grow up reading a lot of superhero comics other than what was in my brother's collection, which was mostly Captain Marvel, Shazam, Captain Marvel, and Superman. He had quite a few books. He still has them. And I read a lot of them as a kid, but the stuff that I bought was usually G.I. Joe or Transformers. But the funny thing about this is, and the funny thing about the spinner rack and the spinner rack experience, which is basically dead now, it doesn't exist. And I think it's a shame, because that's why I picked this up, is because there was no G.I. Joe or Transformers that day that I went into Circle K to get my comics and some candy and all that kind of stuff, as I did quite often growing up as a kid with my dad. And so I got this, because I've heard of Thor before. It's funny, because Thor wasn't all that prominent as far as animation at the time. I believe he did make some appearances either in the Hulk cartoon or the Spider-Man cartoon. I think he was featured at least once or twice. So I knew who the character was. You know, I kind of knew who he was visually. What's interesting about this particular issue is you can kind of see his look is a little bit different. He's got a very, he's got a lot more like armor than kind of what you see in terms of the more, I guess, traditional look that we've kind of gone back to with the MCU. In this one, you can see he's got basically almost like a full suit of armor with chainmail and all that kind of stuff. And it was just kind of an interesting look. But the thing that I remember the most about this book is basically the last image. So to kind of sum up the story, Thor is basically trying to defend this planet that's being attacked by the Celestials, and it's very much, you know, considered an uneven match, because Thor, even though he's a god, he's not a Celestial, and the Celestials are like the ultimate, and Thor is, it's looking like Thor is probably, you know, could lose, that he's not going to be able to take on this this Celestial, that it's too much for him to handle. One thing I really like is the dialogue in this book. It's so like kind of classic Thor type dialogue. You know, there's a lot of vouts and a lot of, you know, that kind of like a older style way of speaking that I really kind of like. Gives Thor sort of that class that, you know, he is, you know, the god of thunder. It's not really more like the comedic take that we see in the MCU.
Right.
You know, I remember watching the first Thor movie, and I actually was surprised how much I enjoyed it. But I feel like in a lot of ways, the characters become a big joke in the MCU as the movies have progressed. You know, the last Thor movie, Ragnarok, is listed as a comedy. It's actually listed as a comedy if you look at the genre, you know? So this is a much more serious version of Thor. This is a very dramatic story where, like I said, Thor is basically doing his job. He has pledged to protect this planet. He knows the odds are against him. There's a very high likelihood he's going to die, and he decides to take on the Celestial anyway. It's really like classic superhero, which we don't see anymore. We don't see the classic superhero that's actually trying to protect the people. You know what I mean? That's one of the things with a lot of this stuff that gets to me, is that a lot of times you don't see that side of it anymore. But Thor is basically going all out, and it's kind of funny because the natives of the planet, they're kind of dominated by this pirate character, who's basically just, all he cares about is saving his own butt and getting away. And, you know, he ends up essentially sacrificing his entire fleet just so he can try to escape on his own. Meanwhile, Thor is just locked in this complete, you know, life and death struggle, you know, fighting against all odds. And eventually what he does, that's really interesting in this book, is eventually what he does is he actually is able to take his life essence, and he's able to focus it into his hammer. He takes his life essence and he's able to focus that into the hammer to do like one super blow to the Celestial's brain, essentially, to actually impact it and possibly do some real damage and take the Celestial out. And the sort of the final image in this book, it's really, really dramatic. He's focused all of his power essentially in this one blow, and it destroys the hammer. The hammer actually is destroyed. He actually destroys the hammer, but he makes the hole in what you could look at as like the Celestial's brain. And he's made the hole. And the next thing you see, there had been this sort of minion that Thor had taken out before, that was sort of like, you could think of him as like an antibody for the Celestial. And it like takes everything Thor has to beat this guy. And then, you know, he does this blow. And the last image you see is Thor with the broken, you know, the broken hammer. All that's left is the handle. And now there's like an army of these guys coming at him. And he's all like, you know, busted up and everything like that. And he's just like, all right, come and get some, you know, kind of thing. And it's a really neat image. And I remember that was the thing that always really struck me about it was seeing the hammer destroyed and all that. That's the first time I ever had seen that. And I thought it was just incredibly intense and crazy and all that kind of stuff. And Thor's just general attitude of, there was no way he was going to give up. There's no way he's going to surrender. He's a true superhero. You know, he is a god. he basically says, hey, if I'm going to die, I'm going to die fighting. You know what I mean? I'm going down. I'm taking as many of you with me as I can, that kind of attitude. So it's a neat story. It's a neat story. And I think the image of him with the broken hammer, I think, looms large, and was even kind of used when they destroyed the hammer in the MCU. I think some of that is there. Have some images here. This is this particular book, by the way. I mean, it came out in 1988, so it's on newsprint. So if I like just show you the book, it's probably going to be very hard to see. But there's some images here that you can see from the book. Some really interesting, cool art and all that kind of stuff that really stands up today, very much so, I think. It's just overall, I think it's a really interesting book. And like I said, I think it's the only Thor comic that I have in my comic collection. And I wouldn't have got it if it hadn't been for the old spinner racks and the fact that they just didn't have any G.I. Joe or Transformers that day.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of titles, a lot of us bought off that spinner rack because they didn't have something we were looking for. I mentioned in a previous episode, I talked about that Jonah Hex issue, and I bought that because they told me, oh, they finally got a Batman comic in, and I ran over, was so excited, and I pulled out the spinner rack. And I was like, this is a Batman, you know. But you know, there's a lot of fun to be had, too. You're always discovering something you weren't terribly familiar with, and a lot of times it ended up being something that you really enjoyed. So that's kind of fun, too. And I think in terms of the storyline, I think Thor's body had been almost crippled or something, and they made that armor to kind of help him stay constituted in order to basically still be Thor, because I think the armor is enchanted, if I remember correctly. But no, yeah, very cool. Very cool.
Exactly. Yeah. The armor is essentially destroyed in this issue too. He's practically naked by the end of this this issue. So
interesting. Cool. Well, if you don't mind, I think we'll go ahead and we'll move on to my last one for tonight, if that's okay with you.
Absolutely.
Okay. All right. Okay. So here is this is my second pick, and this will be the last one for the evening. This is Marvel Superheroes number 75. This features the Incredible Hulk, as you can see from the artwork that's being displayed on your screen. If you are listening to the show, it's the Incredible Hulk, and he is punching the leader, the Hulk villain with the weird giant head, kind of a mad scientist kind of a character. He's punching him and knocking him out of a weird three-legged machine, not too different from something you would have seen like in the old War of the Worlds. I do have a couple notes here I put together. So this is Marvel Superheroes 75. Obviously, this was published by Marvel Comics in October of 1978. This comic, this is actually a replacement of my original one that was destroyed because I read it so much it fell apart. The original one came into my possession by actually trading comics and baseball cards when I was a kid in elementary school. And then this actually is a replacement copy that I found many, many years later and was happy to add back into my collection. This story actually reprints a story that was previously published in Hulk number 123. The writer is the legendary Roy Thomas. The art is by Herb Trimpe. And I've got a couple notes here just to read about them. So Roy Thomas was an American comic book writer, because he is still alive, is an American comic book writer and editor who was Stan Lee's first successor as editor-in-chief of Marvel Comics. He is possibly best known for introducing the pulp magazine hero Conan the Barbarian to American comics, with a series that added to the storyline of Robert E. Howard's character and helped launch a sword and sorcery trend in comics. Thomas is also known for championing the Golden Age comic book heroes, particularly the 1940s superhero team, the Justice Society of America, and for lengthy writing stints on Marvel's X-Men, the Avengers, and DC Comics All-Star Squadron, among many other titles. Among the comic book creators he co-created are Wolverine, Vision, Carol Danvers, Luke Cage, Iron Fist, Ultron, Man-Thing, Red Sonja, Ghost Rider, Red Guardian, Brother Voodoo, and the Valkyrie. Thomas was inducted into the Will Eisner Comic Book Hall of Fame in 2011. So as you can tell, a very distinguished and illustrious legendary writer wrote this comic book that had quite an influence on a very young version of me. The artist is Herb Trimpe. I've always quite liked Herb Trimpe's art. He is an American comic artist and occasional writer. He's best known as the seminal 1970s artist on The Incredible Hulk. He is my Incredible Hulk artist. And as the first artist to draw for publication the character Wolverine, he would later become a breakout star in the X-Men. The legacy of this book for me, it looms pretty large. When I think of The Incredible Hulk fighting a villain, I always think of him fighting the leader. I don't really think of him fighting Abomination or any of the villains that people typically think of. It's always a brain versus brawn, a character with a mental ability versus a character, you know, obviously driven by, you know, passion and rage and brute force. This is a very fun comic. It's a classic, you know, mind versus muscle kind of a story. The basic gist of it, it starts off that the Fantastic Four have managed to capture the Incredible Hulk. Reed Richards, Mr. Fantastic, Fantastic Four, in conjunction with some notes that he's gathered from Bruce Banner, they think they've found a cure. So they attempt to activate the cure. And what it does is enables Bruce Banner to actually be able to control his transformations, and he actually maintains a percentage of his intelligence, which is very much like what they did in Avengers Endgame. So it's kind of that version of the Incredible Hulk. Meanwhile, the leader is scheming to obviously still take over the world and pay back the Incredible Hulk for what he's done to him. And the army has this mechanized device that they've invented. The leader wants it because they can use it to achieve his ends. Along the same lines, there's a subplot where General Thunderbolt Ross and Bruce Banner kind of bury their differences for a little bit, realizing they need to come together over this particular device. The leader managed to steal the device. He actually tries to use it on the Incredible Hulk. The Incredible Hulk eventually obviously wins out the day. I'm not going to give you the particulars because you should track down a copy of this issue and read it. It's a classic, old school, good guy versus bad guy kind of story. But a lot of fun, just classic, you know, old school comics, kind of stuff that I've always loved. So this was my last pick for our favorite comics of yesteryear. So tell me, Eric, had you ever come across this particular issue of the Marvel Superheroes, The Incredible Hulk?
No, I can't say that I did, but I really like the cover. The cover art is really cool. I like that. And I do remember the leader from the Incredible Hulk cartoon in the 80s. And then also, of course, there was a sort of teaser that we were going to see the leader later after the last Hulk movie. But I guess I decided not to proceed with that. That was after they decided to recast the Hulk. I would like to have seen that. It would be neat to see a live action version of the leader. But I haven't read this particular book, but I do really dig that cover. That's a pretty cool cover.
It's fun. It's to me, when I think of comics, I think of two things. I think of the really fun independent black and white explosion books. Most of them had painted covers and black and white interiors. And then when I think of Marvel and DC, I think of these classic four color adventure stories. You know, there's always that melodrama, that underlying story that's moving like a long form narrative forward. But at the same point, you just, in every single issue, you always have the hero villain confrontation or battle. And I've always loved this particular issue because I feel like it epitomizes that idea in a lot of different ways. But this is a comic you don't hear a lot of people talk about. Obviously, it's a reprint of a Hulk story, number one. But number two, this was my introduction to this story. The next, I was familiar with The Incredible Hulk from the television series. And then I saw this comic being passed around and I really wanted to read it because I liked the cover. But also number two, because this is something you would never see on the television series. That's why it piqued my interest. I was like, "Ooh, who is he fighting? Like, this looks really interesting." And so I picked this up and then I read it, fell in love with it. And then basically several years later, I would run across the Batman versus the Incredible Hulk. The leader actually makes a brief cameo in that as sort of like a manifestation of the Incredible Hulk's illusion that the Shaper of Worlds is causing to come upon him and in order to control him mentally. It's just a great classic, just adventure story. One of the reasons I love the Incredible Hulk, and a big reason for why I've always liked the character of the leader. So fun comic.
Is this particular issue a complete story? Like the Thor issue I have it's a cliffhanger. So you don't really get a resolution to the story. Does this one actually resolve the story, or is it also a cliffhanger?
No, I mean, it has a cliffhanger for the Incredible Hulk. I mean, every comic ideally would have a cliffhanger, so you're going to really come back. But no, this initial story between the Incredible Hulk and the leader, it does have a resolution. It has a beginning, a middle, and an end. It sets up a premise, and then it plays it through to the end. But it leaves Bruce Banner and the Incredible Hulk in an interesting sort of situation, questioning, what it means for these different aspects of Bruce Banner or Bruce Banner and the Hulk, if you want to see them as separate entities. It leaves them with a bit of a dilemma. It is a bit of a cliffhanger, but the story with the leader is definitely resolved. I mean, he kind of gets away, but then that's kind of how that all these stories always used to go. The villain always got away. I think back to how much I loved the first Sam Raimi Spider-Man movie. And one of the things I loved about it was that when the Green Goblin is flying away, when he's menacing them at the street fair or whatever it is, he says, we'll meet again, Spider-Man, or I'll get you, the kind of thing. And I love that because that's so classic, comic book cartoon Spider-Man, the villain making that kind of observation as he's managing to get away, but he'll be back. I just love that kind of stuff. I mean, maybe it's a little dated, a little too quaint for today's modern audiences, but I think this stuff is still a lot of fun. And if you're curious to see the kind of interesting stories that entertained a whole generation of kids, here you go. Here's an interesting one I think that you could definitely sample. It's not going to set you back a lot. It's not a terribly expensive issue. You're going to find it in a quarter, quarter or 50-cent box or a dollar box or whatever. But it's a fun comic to add to your collection an interesting read, in my opinion. We want to thank you for listening to this episode of the Retro Rogues Live podcast. You can learn more about Eric Alexander and Five the Live Show on either Twitch, YouTube, or Twitter by searching for BassGod14, that's BASSGOD14, on either YouTube, Twitch, or Twitter. If you are curious about co-host Dave Beatty, you can see some of his art, find social media links, and so much more at his website, DaveBeatty.com. That's DaveBeatty.com. If you enjoyed this episode of the Retro Rogues Live, be sure to like, share, and subscribe.